The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, JVC Broadcasting Management, or its sponsors.
Good morning, Long Island, and welcome to DDI on Autism on 103.9 FM, keeping an eye on autism and giving a voice to its Long Island community. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Romas, and I'm so glad that you can join us this morning as we share and explore all relevant issues related to autism spectrum disorder. Well, you know, we're going to continue our conversation this morning. The subject of last week couldn't have been more important. We were dealing with the issue of grief, bereavement, and loss, especially as it pertains to persons with intellectual disability and the staff who support them. My guests are Consuelo Sr., Assistant Coordinator of both Sex Education and Clinical Curriculum Development for YAI, and my alumni and colleagues, Kate Ratuzny and Maria Melillo, both from DDI, as I said, Site Coordinator and LMSW for Adult Day Services. Welcome back, guys.
Thank you.
Good to have you back, and a big thank you from me for taking this time. You know, I want to begin the conversation with a thought, and that's that there has been really very little consideration so far to the critical distinction between normal and pathological grief in individuals with intellectual disability. And, you know, one culprit may be what we've termed diagnostic overshadowing, you know, that tendency to ascribe, any emotion or behavioral difficulty to a disability itself and really to minimize the importance of emotional state or situational changes. And one of the reasons I'm so happy to have this conversation with you all is that you don't do that. In fact, you're expert in not doing that and seeing the full depth of grief despite somebody's intellectual disability. So let's begin there. Let's kind of start where we left off and talk a little bit about what comes to play that would allow people with intellectual disabilities to somehow be under-recognized when it comes to their grief. Why are we not seeing it? Why are we sometimes kind of overlooking it or not giving it the attention it's due? What's that about?
So I think maybe sometimes we don't want to hurt the people that we care about, or we are not sure how they're going to respond or handle it, or we just don't know how to identify their grief, and all of those things are a component.
I think also the lack of the communication challenges, mm-hmm. where some people may not use words to communicate. So you'd have to then read behavior, mm-hmm. or oftentimes what we expect the grief to look like, it doesn't look like. So then we don't think that it is.
Yes. Yes.
We may say someone being very angry, and we're thinking they're angry when actually it's the grief that's being expressed.
Yes.
And like you said, maybe they're, you know, not wanting to watch their favorite show, and we're now thinking that it's depression, or we're thinking that they're isolating themselves, not realizing that that's a part of the grief process.
Yeah, I think that's important, because even in the general population, you know, grief can still be expressed differently.
Yes.
We've talked a little bit about that. You know, I know, Kate, you work closely with adults, and certainly you've observed people who have been involved in the grief process. When you're working with people who are on the spectrum, what kind of things do you find yourself looking for that might be evidence that that person could be going through a period of loss?
Like you had said before, changes in any baseline behaviors.
Right.
I just recently was sitting with somebody at adult who had lost their mother.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to verbalize his feelings with me because he trusted me, but they're, you know, with staff at his day hab, he might not have been more comfortable with, and it showed more behaviorally, and they took it behaviorally. Mm-hmm. So I had gone to the dayhab and just did an in-service on compassion and empathy, and explained how he's going through the grief process in front of everybody at dayhab days after his mother had passed, and how, you know, if we lose somebody that we love, we typically have time from work we can take off, or, you know, vacation time, or to be able to get away and grieve either privately, if that was your choice, or around friends and family. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't have that opportunity. He has to come right back to program. So,
yeah, I've got to say that I really appreciate that point, because it's so insightful that for so many of us, we have the luxury and as well often the desire to experience and process our grief privately and with a lot of dignity. And the way you framed that was spot on. This idea that this person may be compelled, and perhaps not, shouldn't be, to display his grief for all to see publicly. And that's something a lot of us would choose not to do, and maybe to give that person and all the people we support a little more choice around how they want to go about that, or about that or not.
I think staff that are not trained properly might be quick to jump to say, oh, well, this person's being non-compliant. All of a sudden, mm-hmm. we're seeing all this non-compliance. They're refusing program. They're refusing their medication. Mm-hmm. They're refusing activities. They don't want to go out into the community.
Activities
What's going
that
on?
They might normally...
Yeah, and we
were
need
preferred.
To, right, we need to recognize that, no, maybe this person just needs some time to
sure.
relax and deal with what's going on in their head.
Sure, and give them that space, and like you're like kind of like you're all saying, to really be sensitized to what those changes in baseline might look like. And you know, and when you think about it, you know, there really are not a whole lot of viable, valid, reliable assessments around grief for this population. There aren't all that many in the general population, and it's, and as we've said to each other on a couple of occasions, it's not a one-size-fits-all response to it. It's not even a one-size-fits-all assessment necessarily, because in order to right, in order to really be able to appraise someone's response to a loss, you kind of have to know the person.
Mm-hmm.
You have to know them to know what's going on, and I think that's challenging. You know, mm-hmm. it's challenging even in the best of circumstances. You know, one of the points that we talked about in the initial airing was some of the challenges that persons with ID or persons on the spectrum who have ID are facing, particularly around language and cognitive processing, and also something called, that I've been calling, secondary losses, which is the reality that someone who is grieving has lost very often not only the person that they have been bonded with and loved, potentially loved, but also all the activities and comforts and perks in life that that person brought. So it's a love, it's the bond, but was this the person that took you out on Saturdays? Was this the one that read to you, that, you know, called you on every Thursday or sent you a nice note? So you're losing, of course you're losing that feeling, potentially, but you're losing. Do you think that fits into what's going on with the group? Is that secondary loss piece critical and potentially more critical for our population? What are your thoughts?
Yes, I do believe it is, and that can prolong grief.
Yes.
You know, that's one of the things that can prolong grief, because now you're not just missing the person, but you're missing an activity or a special event, a time when you felt special and you felt different. And, you know, one of the things that we were talking about is, especially in a day, in a residential setting or even a day program setting, is that often there is a replacement person, but not a replacement relationship.
Oh, nicely put. So nicely put. Yes.
And that makes it different, because now you are going to the movie, but it's not the same feeling. It's not that special anymore.
Right.
So the loss is still there. The grieving is still there.
And to even take that one step further, if you have someone who maybe needs help in the bathroom or with showering or dressing, that staff person is replaced, and now like you said, that relationship has not been replaced. So that can kind of even feed into more trauma, because now another person, we have to think about dignity and respect for our guys too. And we're replacing that person. But do I want this new person helping me get dressed in the morning? Maybe not.
Maybe not. You know, I think that's important distinction too, between the function that a person may have provided as opposed to the emotional connection that is also a part of the core of that relationship. You know, one of the things that we had shared at one point that I kind of wanted to think a little bit more about is that, you know, the lives of the people we support are often characterized by lots of people coming in and out of those lives far too quickly. But I'm not certain that that lends itself to resilience around grief, because the few bonds that have been sustained can therefore have even greater meaning and therefore greater potential for protracted and potentially traumatic grief. You know, I'm hearing my little break music, but, you know, when we come back, what I'd like to talk about with you a little bit more is how we can support staff, what kind of advice and considerations and training we should be giving our staff so they can actually provide agency for some of those secondary losses and be there to bolster people during times of extraordinary pain and loss. So stay with us. We'll be right back.